Dhruva Maharaj, the whole pastime of Dhruva Maharaj going from Sakam to Nishkam Bhakti, from really strong, intense material desire to having no material desire. We just finished discussing the prayers that were given by Dhruva to the personality of Godhead, Vishnu. And now we're going to continue. The topic is being discussed by Maitreya, who is pictured on the left, speaking to Vidura, who is pictured on the right. This is a carryover from the third canto Bhagavatam, where Vidura is on pilgrimage from way back when he left Hastinapur, went to visiting various holy places. One of the places he visited was Vrindavan. There, after meeting Uddhava, Vidura was sent to find Maitreya, because Krishna had said, soon he will come. And so Vidura went to meet Maitreya. My dear Vidura, when Dhruva Maharaj, who had good intentions in his heart, finished his prayer, the Supreme Lord, the Personality of Godhead, who is very kind to his devotees and servants, congratulated him and spoke as follows. Imagine having a conversation with the Personality of Godhead. Pretty elevated, huh? The Personality of Godhead said, "My dear Dhruva, son of the king, you have executed pious vows, and I also know the desire within your heart, although your desire is very ambitious and very difficult to fulfill. I shall favor you with its fulfillment. All good fortune unto you." So what was his desire? It was not just he wanted a kingdom, but he wanted a kingdom, in essence, greater than Brahma. What's a kingdom that's greater than Brahma? It's the spiritual world, right? Very difficult to fulfill that such a desire, but I shall favor you with its fulfillment, all good fortune unto you. Badramte, let all good fortune be to you. Oh, Prince, Rajanya Balaka, your desire for power is natural. For a king, for the son of a king, power. That's why he became the son of a king. But then, you will not give me prema. That's a doubt. All auspiciousness to you, Badramte, do not worry, I will also give you prema. This is indicated by the word api. The Lord says, you previously said, this is now Dhruva speaking to Narada. We see in the image that Dhruva speaking to Narada. Oh, Brahmana, please tell the correct method for me, desiring the best position in the three worlds, which has not been attained by my forefathers or others. And the Lord then says, please accept that place now. That's his eventual residence. He has to go back and rule the kingdom for some time. We'll hear. So Vishnu says, the fact that Dhruva Maharaj was very much afraid in his mind, for he had aspired after material benefit in discharging his devotional service, and this was hampering. There's a bad ring back. Can you fix it? For he had aspired after material benefit in discharging his devotional service, and this was hampering him from reaching the stage of love of God. in Bhagavad Gita 2:44, it is said, Bhogaishvarya Prasaktanam, to those who are addicted to material pleasure, cannot be attracted to devotional service. The Lord assured Dhruva Maharaj that Dhruva would not be bereft of the Lord's love. It's still ringing. Let's see if you can fix it. But this is our, the overall theme of the whole Dhruva story. Moving, we've seen several charts. Lower left corner is all material desire, it's all about me. The upper right corner is all about Krishna, no material desire. So transitioning from mixed to pure, that's the Dhruva story. Childishly, initially Dhruva had material desires, and at the same time, he had the pure aspiration to be a great devotee. It wasn't just material desire. It was on the encouragement of his mother. He wanted to become a devotee, and mixed with the kingdom aspiration. Generally, the Lord does not award a pure devotee material opulence, even though he may desire it. But Dhruva Maharaja's situation and qualification was a special case. In spite of his having material opulence, he would never be deviated from love of God. There's a nice description. It's maybe going to come up in the upcoming section. In relation to the Brahmana named Sudama that visited Krishna in Dwarka, he went to school together, Sudama Brahman and Krishna and Balaram. So when they were both married, Sudama's wife encouraged Sudama to go ask Krishna for some help because he was so poor. And he didn't want to go, but his wife wanted, you know, he complied with his wife's wish. And there's some commentary there that says, normally the Lord doesn't award, just like it says, material opulence. But there's an exception. And the exception are Ambarish, Dhruva, and Prahlad. And the reason the exception was made is because they had no material desire. If one has even a trace of material desire, and one gets material opulence, one gets covered quickly. And the personality, Godhead, and oneself, and everything gets lost. So normally the Lord doesn't so easily give material opulence, but for Dhruva he did. The kingdom, rule for a long time, and then come to this very exalted place where you'll have even more opulence, but he won't become contaminated. So two more verses go together. The personality of God had continued. My dear Dhruva, I shall award you the glowing planet known as the pole star. That's the very top. That's the pole star. Which will continue to exist even after the dissolution at the end of the millennium. No one has ever ruled this planet, which is surrounded by all the solar systems, planets, and stars. Now that's a Prabhupada translation, so he is speaking of solar systems as plural. Because we don't normally hear that. We normally hear, in this universe there's one sun, not there's many suns and solar systems, plural. In any case, this map that we've seen before, or drawing, there's ropes that are indicated on the right side. Ropes of air are prabaha. Those ropes of air are moved by another wind, the wind that moves all those ropes. It blows the ropes and thus blows the planets, and it moves in a clockwise direction, and that's how the planets move. as Dhruva Loka itself is turning, the ropes turn, but they're assisted by Dakshinavarta, wind, that moves clockwise. And thus the planets are moving in a clockwise manner below, in a vertical dimension below the pole star, but circumambulating the pole star like when circumambulates a deity or a tulsi plant or something. You keep to your right side and circumambulate in a clockwise direction. And it gives some numbers there. Dhruva Loka is so many miles above the sun. And, yeah, the sun planet is shown in that drawing, the sun and the moon. And that bluish drawing in the middle, it's, Prabhupada translates it as dolphin, but it's a configuration of the heavenly planets. It's not a physical form that's in the sky. It's a type of meditation done by yogis that want to go to higher planets. Shishumara, it's called. Shishumara. It's used in meditation by yogis. It's depicting the general configuration of the celestial planets. All the luminaries in the sky circumambulate this planet, Dhruva Loka, just as bulls tread around a central pole for the purpose of crushing grains. Keeping the pole star to their right, all the stars inhabited by the great sages like Dharma, Agni, Kashyapa, and Shukra circumambulate this planet, which continues to exist even after the dissolution of all others. Although the pole star existed before its occupation by Dhruva Maharaj, it had no predominating deity. Now here's another commentary. There's the pole star. So the Big Dipper, the Dipper part of the Dipper, points to the pole star. It's very bright in the sky. You can see it. I give you that residence, Kshiti, which is eternal, Dhruva, possessing the zodiac belt of the planets, constellations, and stars, which are like oxen circulating around the central pillar to which they are tied. This place remains fixed for the duration of Brahma's life, for those living for that duration. Kalpa Vasinam. At the time of final destruction, some say that Dhruva ascends to Mahavaikuntha, and some say he doesn't. So what happens to Dhruva? He becomes king for a long time. He goes to Dhruva Loka for the duration of the universe. And some say when the universe is withdrawn, that planet remains, but Dhruva goes to Mahavaikuntha. Some say. Even though existing within the material universe, Dhruva Loka has the qualities of Svetadweep, Mathura, and Dwarka. That there's an asterisk, Kalpa Vasinam, and the BBT commentary, this is Prabhupada's word for word, that's taken as a Deha Brahma, Kalpa. After your father goes to the forest and awards to you the rule of his kingdom, you will rule continuously the entire world for 36,000 years. And all your senses will continue to be as strong as they are now. You will never become old. Wow. The Lord continued, sometime in the future, your brother Uttama will go hunting in the forest, and while absorbed in hunting, he will be killed. Your stepmother, Suruchi, being maddened upon the death of her son, will go to search him out in the forest, but she will be devoured by a forest fire. And then commentary explains, don't offend Dhruva, because if you make the mad elephant offense of offending a devotee, you're going to have reactions. So over on the right, that shows Vaishnava Parad. And over on the left, it shows an elephant knocking over a car. Don't antagonize the elephant. You might be in trouble. So commentary says, because of having insulted Dhruva Maharaj, Suruchi would become mad upon the death of her son and would enter a forest fire, and thus her life would be ended. This was specifically mentioned by the Lord to Dhruva because he was determined for revenge against her. Now, he wasn't still in that disposition. He had given all that up. But it was something that he held before, wanting the kingdom and revenge were both wanted by Dhruva. They were gone, but he wanted Dhruva to know it's going to happen. The Lord continued, I am the heart, not in the heart, but I am the heart of all sacrifices. You will be able to perform many great sacrifices and also give great charities. In this way, you will be able to enjoy the blessings of material happiness in this life, and at the time of your death, you'll be able to remember me. Now, way back in the beginning of the previous chapter, his mother, Suniti, said, your great-grandfather, who was Brahma, became so powerful he could create a universe. And your grandfather, Swayambhuva Manu, he did this, same, great sacrifices, great charity, and achieve spiritual perfection. So you should do like that too. And he did do like that. Vishnu is saying, you will do like that. Many sacrifices, great charities, enjoy material happiness, but never forget me. That's special. We'll say it again because it was mentioned. Now it's being said again in a different way. Normally the Lord doesn't award material opulence to a devotee because there's a tendency to become bewildered by material opulence and try to become the enjoyer if there's even a trace of material desire. But because Dhruva was squeaky clean, no material desire, pretty amazing, then the Lord was announcing blessings of material happiness in this life. Blessings of material happiness is not really a blessing for those who have a tendency to be enjoyers because it obscures your Krishna consciousness. It obscures, you become attracted to the opulence instead of to the source of the opulence, Krishna. It's just conditioning, this material nature. So there's this nice phrase, I'm sure you've heard, Ante Narayana Smriti. The end of life, Ante, one should remember the personality of Godhead, Narayana Smriti. All of the duties of life are for that final exam, a pass-fail. Pass is you remember Krishna or remember Narayana. And fail is you think of the material thing that you are attached to and the thing that you wanted to accomplish and didn't get to accomplish yet. And all those things that our mind goes to when we're chanting japa instead of the holy name. All those things. In the purport, Prabhupada writes, notice the graphic, there's Paramatma in the heart, or it's the form of Krishna in the heart, and the form of Krishna in the mind. The result of whatever we do in executing spiritual activities is successful if we can remember Narayan, the Supreme Personality Godhead. This program of constant remembrance can be disturbed by many things, too many things. What are some prominent tendencies or emotional responses of our own that throw us away from remembering Krishna or being connected with Krishna? So that's an open-ended question. And in our the other previous classes, there are little reflection exercises or group discussion kind of exercises to help integrate this message, so it's not just a nice story. And then when the story's over, you go back to business as usual. It's meant to stimulate our thoughtfulness of Krishna going forward in time, not just while we're hearing the narration. And it's good to identify things that pull you away. And each of us probably have our, you know, favorite ones. Or different stages of life, things that really are occupying your attention. Let's say young boy, young girl, and it's, you know, boy-girl attraction. Or it's somebody who's preparing for an exam and it's just their exam. Or whatever, whatever. It's some conflict that you have with another person and that your attention goes to that conflict and not to the source of everything, etc. There are things that the mind becomes distracted by, tendencies, and emotional responses that block remembrance of Krishna. So Prabhupada writes, the most important factor in this verse is how to remember Krishna always. And the principle that helps keep that remembrance going is sacrifice. That is, rather than be attached and try to be the enjoyer of, you engage in offering things to Krishna. That's what sacrifice means. And the best of all sacrifices, the Sankirtan Yajna, that sacrifice. Engage together with others in collectively, congregationally chanting Krishna's holy name. Commentary by Vishwanath writes, you will go to my abode, worshipped by all planets, higher than the Big Dipper, the planet of the planets of the seven rishis, from which you will not return, having gone there. So in Western astronomy, it's called the Big Dipper. In Vedic astronomy, it's called the Sapta Rishi Loka, the planets of the seven rishis. And the dipper, it shows. The dipper shows the direction and even the distance. The distance between the star in the bottom and the one just above it to the right, that's X. And that X is multiplied by 4 is the difference, the distance between the one of the cup of the lip, the lip of the cup, excuse me, and the pole star. It's just an interesting astronomy fact. Tato katasi matstanam, my abode. You're going to go to my abode. Sarvaloka namaskritam, which is worshipped by all worlds. Sarvaloka namaskritam. Prabhupada writes in his purport, Dhruvaloka, or the pole star, is the abode of Lord Vishnu within this material world. Upon it, there is an ocean of milk. And within that ocean, There's an island known as Svetadvipa. It is clearly indicated that this planet is situated above the seven planetary systems of the Rishis, Sapta Rishis. And because this planet is Vishnu Loka, it is worshipped by all other planetary systems. Now, the worship is in the form of one, is the circumambulation. So, Prabhupada described, you know, many times, the structure of this universe is, there is the pole star, below it is Swarga, below Swarga is Bhuvarloka, and below Bhuvarloka is Bhuloka, and the seven lower planetary systems. So the Bhuloka, Bhuvarloka, and Swargaloka, the one when you look up into the sky and the celestial planets that you see, those are those two, and they're moving in the sky, circumambulating the pole star, moving in a clockwise direction. So that's part of their worship. And the residents are offering prayers to Vishnu. So they're worshiping Vishnu and offering prayers to Vishnu, who resides there. This is also discussed in Brihat Bhagavatamrita, this particular verse, where it says, Indra is unsure where the Lord is. He might be in Vaikuntha, beyond the material world, or else on the Vaikuntha planet, Ramapriya, inside the universe. There's another name for Svetadvipa. Rama is the goddess of fortune. Rama. Lakshmi is in Vaikuntha realm, and in the Svetadvipa, it's Rama. Same as Mahavishnu. We don't see the goddess of fortune at the feet of Mahavishnu, because she's within as Rama Devi, enjoying pastimes within in his yoga nidra, eternal pastimes enjoying together in that way. But with Garbhadakshe Vishnu, she's at his feet, massaging his feet. So that's Rama Devi. And same in Svetadvipa, there's Shiradakshe Vishnu, and the goddess of fortune is there. Rama Devi. So that planet is sometimes called Rama Priya. The Supreme Lord might be on Dhruva's planet known as Vishnupada, or he might be on the island of Svetadvipa in the ocean of milk. That's Brihat Bhagavatamrita, part 1, chapter 2. Here's part 1, chapter 1. This is describing what Brihat Bhagavatamrita is. Jaimini Rishi, the principal authority for the Samaveda, spoke Brihat Bhagavatamrita to Sri Janamejaya, a worthy son of Maharaj Parikshit, as a kila or supplement to Jaimini's own Mahabharata, much like the Harivamsa is a kila or supplement of Vyasadeva's Mahabharata. So now, let's just back up. Do you know who is Sanatana Goswami? Yes? No? Something of an idea. One of Lord Chaitanya's chief associates. The next generation after Lord Chaitanya, many authors, they have the six Goswamis of Vrindavan. Sanatana is the eldest. He's the author of this Brihat Bhagavatamrita, and he explains, what is it? Well, long ago, Jaimini Rishi was narrating to Maharaj Parikshit, to Janamejaya, Jaimini Rishi's Mahabharata. Vyasadeva wrote Mahabharata. Jaimini Rishi also composed a text, which is the history of Greater India, called Mahabharata. So he was narrating that to Janamejaya, who went, after hearing it, went, wow, that was really good. I've heard Mahabharata before, but this is the best. Do you have anything more? Do you have a supplement to that? Just like when Vyasadeva compiled Mahabharata, there's a supplement to his Mahabharata. That supplement is Harivamsa by Vyasadeva. So Janamejaya said, sure, there's a supplement. The Sanskrit word is kila. And Brihad Bhagavatamrita is that. It's Jamini Rishi's supplement of his Mahabharata narrated to Janamejaya. And then compiled by Sanatana Goswami. And he makes commentary on it as well. Dhruva Loka is one of the lokas like Sweta Dweep, Mathura, and Dwarka. That is to say, all three of those, they're eternal. Dwarka is eternal. The sphere in the spiritual sky, Dwarka is eternal. Mathura is eternal. And Sweta Dweep is a section in Krishna Loka that's also eternal. The great sage Maitreya said, after being worshipped and honored by the boy, Dhruva Maharaj, and after offering him his abode, Lord Vishnu on the back of Garuda returned to his abode as Dhruva Maharaj looked on. So imagine his feeling. 5-year-old boy, he just had this really amazing exchange. The personality Godhead is now in the back of Garuda and he takes off. A simple illustration. The Lord returns to his abode. Now, what's he going to feel? He is going to have two feelings, ecstasy and sadness. It's ecstasy as he just met the Lord, and sadness. He had all these dumb material desires, and now he has to stay around here for 36,000 years and live out those dumb material desires. Although he got the kingdom, he could have gone with the Supreme Lord. But he didn't, because he had these dumb material desires. So he's feeling sad and ecstatic at the same time, because he just had this exchange. Despite having achieved the desired result of his determination by worshipping the lotus feet of the Lord, Dhruva Maharaj was not very pleased. As you can see in the painting. Thus, he returned to his home, presumably after crying for some time. So that's text 27. Here's the commentary. Although Dhruva had attained his desired goal from worshipping the feet of Vishnu through his determination, and he returned home, but he was still not satisfied. So Madhura wants to know, my dear Brahmana, the abode of the Lord is very difficult to attain. It can be attained only by pure devotional service, which alone pleases the most affectionate, merciful Lord. Dhruva Maharaj achieved this position even in one life. It was actually in 6 months. And he was very wise and conscientious. Why then was he not very pleased? Good question. Having attained the supreme abode of the merciful Lord, which is rarely attained through worshipping the Lord's feet within one lifetime, although he was knowledgeable, why did he consider himself unfulfilled? And the same purport, the word artha vit, which refers to one who knows how to discriminate between reality and illusion, is very significant in this connection. And artha vit is also called the Paramahamsa. Paramahamsa is pictured here. Hamsa means swan, and Parama is supreme swan. So the most elevated position of consciousness is the Paramahamsa, Vaishnav, like a swan, Paramahamsa. supreme. So artha, vit means to know, and artha means that which is to be gained, like dharma artha, kama moksha. Artha in that sense is normally conventionally taken to be economic development, because that's generally what people want. But that's just the modern or the conventional interpretation. Artha means something that's desired or something that's valuable. Artha. The one who knows artavit, that which is really significant and reality and important, and what is not, that's an artavit person. And that's similar to a paramahansa in Prabhupada's words. So now let's review. Dhruva's gotten what he wanted, but he's having some regret. So Maitreya is answering this question. Why did he feel not like ecstatic? He got what he wanted. Maitreya answers, Dhruva Maharaja's heart, which was pierced by the arrows of harsh words of his stepmother, was greatly aggrieved. And thus, when he fixed upon his goal of life, he did not forget her misbehavior. He did not demand actual liberation from this material world, but at the end of his devotional service, when the Supreme Personality of God had appeared before him, he was simply ashamed of material demands he had in his mind. So he's now free from material desire, but he's remembering his previous condition where he was full of material desire, and he felt very remorseful that that was what was the fuel in his tank. That was what was propelling him. Like anything. Dhruva considered himself imperfect. He prayed with a desire for a high position, but on attaining a benediction which surpassed that material position, he criticized himself. Although in pure devotional service, there is no demand from the Lord, because of his childish nature, he had demanded something. Thus, although the Lord also fulfilled his desire, he was not very pleased. Rather, he was ashamed that he had demanded something from the Lord, for he should not have done this. Dhruva Maharaj, influenced by a revengeful attitude towards his insulting stepmother, that's the insulting stepmother on the left with her hand on her hip, saying, get down. You can't sit on your father's lap. So he had this revengeful attitude towards his insulting stepmother. He didn't even think of mukti, nor did he know what mukti was. Therefore, he failed to aim for mukti as his goal of life. Notice all around there's flames in that painting. That's what's circling down at the bottom. He's like really angry. Sense gratification means striving to dominate over material nature. It can be in this fashion, the austerities that he did, or whatever, the hankering to have this kingdom. The whole competition between conditioned souls is based upon domination of this material nature. Easy to understand, right? Some people, they just compete who can dominate material nature better, whether it's politics or athletics or scholarship or in the workplace or on the highway, whatever it is. Dhruva Maharaj's propensity in the beginning was like that, domination. He wanted to dominate this material world. in a greater position than Lord Brahma. He was very much ashamed and remorseful and morose to think that although he had gone to Madhuvan, giving up the kingdom of his father, and he had gotten a spiritual master like Narada, he was still thinking of revenge against his stepmother and wanted to occupy an exalted post within this material world. So the image is meant to show he was thinking of broken glass. Instead, he got a diamond. That he was thinking material, instead he got spiritual. By the mercy of Vishnu. Big mercy. The Vasudeva state is the state of consciousness that's pure. Just like the father of Krishna was named Vasudeva. And it's said because he had Vasudeva consciousness, Krishna entered his Vasudeva mind. Purified mind. And then he became born, he was called Vasudeva, son of Vasudeva. So this is going to be explaining now this Vasudeva state that Dhruva had achieved. Dhruva Maharaj was elevated to the Vasudeva platform when he saw the Supreme Personality of Godhead present personally before him. The Vasudeva platform refers to the stage at which material contamination is conspicuous by absence only. Or, in other words, where there is no question of the material modes of nature, and one can therefore see the Supreme Personality of Godhead. I mean, when you listen carefully to Prabhupada's lectures, he speaks of principles, but a phrase that he makes mention of again and again is, this is the process that brings one to perfection. Now, for the most part, most of us, commonly, we just want relief from distress. And when that relief from distress is kind of at a reasonable position, we become a little complacent. You know, in some enjoyment, often material enjoyment, you know, a modest amount, sufficient amount of material enjoyment, maybe even some bliss, like some special happiness, keeps us going. That's the fruitive platform, material platform. But when that contamination is completely gone, which happened to Dhruva, then one can see the personality of Godhead. He was eligible because he was qualified. So that first part was regret. Now, moving from resentment to responsibility, because he had resentment towards his stepmother and towards his father too. Because his father just like said nothing. He could have said something, could have pacified the boy or all kinds of said stop to Suruchi. He didn't. So Dhruva Maharaj's recognition of Narada and Krishna's mercy and his own conditioned tendency. So with proper resources, we can move from our covered state to a pure state, away from the conditioned tendencies towards pure tendencies. Dhruva Maharaj thought to himself, this is the translation of text 30, to endeavor to be situated in the shade of the lotus feet of the Lord is not an ordinary task, because even the great brahmacharis headed by Sanandana, four kumaras, Sanandana, who practiced Ashtanga Yoga in trance, attained the shelter of the Lord's lotus feet only after many, many births. Within 6 months, I achieved the same result. And yet, due to my thinking differently from the Lord, I fell down from my position. So the phrase, differently from the Lord, is pratak matihi. Matihi is meditating or thinking or contemplating. A Pratak means separate. My thinking was separate from what's important to the Lord. I was thinking what's important to me. And that's our material condition. We're not so much, I mean, to some degree, but not so much thinking of what's important to the Lord, what can I do in service to the Lord. We're thinking, you know, what's going to make me happy and this and that and put them together in combination, that's going to make me happy. It's about, we're at the center. And placing Krishna at the center, it's revolutionary. But the thinking separately, that's this pratak bina. And that's why he's feeling this sadness. That's the response. Maitreya is being asked by Vidura, why was he sad? He got what he wanted. Here is text 31. Dhruva says, alas, just look at me. I am so unfortunate. I approached the lotus feet of the Supreme Personality Godhead, who can immediately cut the chain of repetition of birth and death, but still, out of foolishness, I prayed for things which are perishable. Now, it's in the past, and he doesn't have that situation, but he's remembering the place that he was in and feeling really badly. That was my whole absorption. Out of foolishness. Anatmya. Anatmya means that which is devoid of atma, the state of ignorance. Although the devotee does not ask, the Lord destroys material existence for the devotee. I attained his lotus feet just by having received Vaishnav Diksha. I prayed to attain what I had vowed, which is temporary. That is my fault. The Lord, however, by his mercy, gave me a place which is not temporary. It wasn't even like, hey, that's what I want. I was thinking material. And he gave it to me anyways. How kind is Krishna? So now, a reflection, what could be the cause of my ignorance? This is Dhruva. Is it the influence of the demigods who became envious seeing my austerities? Because that happens. Demigods have mystic powers. And sometimes, it's not only Indra, sometimes other demigods, they get nervous. Here's somebody doing austerities, maybe they have some ambition to bump me off and take my place. Or something. So he's thinking, you know, how did I develop this ignorance? Well, the demigods knew I had this capacity for austerity and they intervened. No. Just the opposite. They were overwhelmed by the degree of his austerities. So let's go back. We're almost done here. Let's consider what were the original instructions of the sage to Narada, to Dhruva. When they first met, he was testing his determination. He said, oh, Dhruva, first of all, you're not going to reach Vishnu by a get-back mentality. It doesn't fit. You have to be pure. And that's not pure, so let go of that. Could not go. Dhruva, you're just a little boy. And to great sages, they very austere persons, for lifetimes they can't achieve this, so you should just go back to the palace. Maybe when you grow up, you can come back again. And, you know, testing is determination. It's very rarely achieved, and very difficult. He was very determined. So those were instructions. Then after those instructions, he could see Dhruva said, what you've said is correct. You've described a path by which I can become peaceful, and I accept that what you said is correct. But I'm Kshatriya spirited. I want a kingdom. So please give me a way by which I can get the kingdom. As my mother said, by the lotus feet of Vishnu, anything's possible. Siddhartha said, very good. Your mother gave you good instruction. So this is the next. The process of bhakti was given. Dhruva has a doubt. Well, if it was the demigods were covering my intelligence, so I had all this material desire instead, and only for this reason could I not accept the genuine benediction of the sages, the instructions of Narada? No. I was under the influence of the illusory energy, being ignorant of actual facts. I was sleeping on her lap, under a vision of duality. This is translation of the verse. I saw my brother as my enemy, and falsely I lamented within my heart, thinking, they are my enemies. We went over this way back. His mother said it. Narada said it. Now he's realizing it. It's a big deal. Friend to enemy is a big deal in material consciousness. It's a covering factor, guaranteed. Friend to enemy. It's part of this vision of duality instead of seeing the soul. We make friends and enemies as dictated by the illusory energy. Dhruva Maharaj therefore said, Daivim Mayam Upashrita. The cause of his bewilderment was his association with the illusory material energy. It wasn't demigods. It was just the energy of the Lord that was covering him because of his forgetfulness of Krishna. But when that forgetfulness of Krishna became removed, remembrance of Krishna, the covering was removed. Same for us. That's the application point. When there's vision of duality, we saw this image before, that's an image of Maya. She, under her authority, the three modes of nature, goodness, passion, ignorance, are acting. We become covered. There's a similar teaching by Prahlad Maharaj. There's a photograph of Prahlad Maharaj in Mayapur during Chandan Yatra. But he's covered in sandalwood. There, in the seventh canto, Prahlad Maharaj says, let me offer my respectful obeisances unto the Supreme Personality of Godhead, whose external energy has created the distinctions of my friend and my enemy. By deluding the intelligence of men, indeed I am now actually experiencing this, although I have previously heard it from authoritative sources. He's speaking to his teachers, Chandana Marka. Who's the enemy that has spoiled your intelligence? You're thinking of Vishnu instead of Hiranyakashipu. Who has done this? Those are enemies. Then Prahlad makes this statement. Pretty amazing. This friends and enemies delusion is Maya. And now I'm seeing it. So it's something we, in spiritual life, we need to go beyond. And you can go beyond by spiritual conception, not just by getting some anesthesia out and anesthetizing your consciousness so you don't see friends and enemies. It's purification. Rather, Prahlad says, everyone is actually a servant, not an enemy or friend, and everyone is working under different directions from the Lord, who directs every living entity according to his mentality. You see that slide 51 to 57 on the bottom? We're almost done. This is text 34. I prayed for useless things, which are like medicine given to a dead person. Having pleased the Lord, who is the soul of the universe, difficult to please by austerities, and who can destroy material existence I prayed for material enjoyment since I was devoid of good fortune. Nice painting. Dhruva and Garuda and Lord Vishnu. Next text. Because of my state of complete foolishness and paucity of pious activities, although the Lord offered me his personal service, I wanted material name, fame, and prosperity. My case is just like that of a poor man who, when he satisfied a great emperor who wanted to give him anything he might ask, out of ignorance, asked only a few broken grains of husk rice. So that's it for our class. That's text 53. This third step, moving from resentment to responsibility. That's the theme for the whole section. So now he's feeling gratitude. There's regret of his past, taking responsibility for that foolishness, and now he's filled with gratitude. Okay, Vishwanath writes, what pride I have, manaha, asking for material things. It is just like a poor man having lost his intelligence, kina punyena, begging some grains of rice from the emperor. However, being clever and very generous, the king gives more wealth than one can imagine to that person. Similarly, the Lord gave me his own abode to live in. Oh, I am the height of foolishness. What unlimited mercy and generosity of the Lord. Dhruva then became completely paralyzed in astonishment for a moment. And then, if we desire material prosperity or anything other than the service of the Lord and his devotees, it is a sign of our misfortune. And commonly there's desire for other things. And somewhere in there is a desire for association of devotees and service to the Lord. I remember visiting Balaram Prasad's home before his wife left her body with cancer. You know the family? They live out here in Naperville. Okay, so she had cancer. She has, you know, a teenage son and daughter, and she wanted to be with her family to the end. And they watched her withering, you know, her body getting thinner and weaker. But I remember this very clearly. Balaram Prasad said as soon as she got a little energy, she was up and making garlands for the deities and making some special preparation for a festival. And she just loves service. After doing that little bit of activity with cancer, she was wasted. But, you know, a little bit of energy, some people are just very service-minded. And the association of devotees and the opportunity to do service to the Lord and his devotees, that's good fortune, having such a desire. And not having such a desire, but instead the material things, that's the greatest misfortune in the human form of life. One may amass stuff. That's the greatest misfortune. Because forgetfulness of human form of life's higher purpose is completely covered and forgotten. That's great misfortune. And through association of devotees, that misfortune can be changed. That's what happened to Dhruva. He was way down there in the I want a kingdom, I want to get back. Not just my father's kingdom, I'm the firstborn son. What, she forget her. I'm the firstborn son, I've got my rights. I want a kingdom better than my father and better than, so like, I'll show them the Kshatriya spirit, mode of passion. Now he's gone beyond that. He's feeling very grateful that although I had those material desires, the Lord took them away and gave me his own kingdom. Whew. But I got to stay here and rule for 36,000 years. Okay, so that's our discussion from chapter 9 of Canto 4. Really rich, really, like, you know, and that Srimad Bhagavatam that's sitting on your shelf here, there's lots of really nice things. Nice, really nice thing. And then to hear them and discuss them in the association of devotees, that makes it even nicer. Okay. So he's praying for association of devotees because then we can really relish and more deeply understand the topics of Krishna and devotional service. So we're ready to see if there's some comments or discussion in the room. Yeah. Nice topic. How did he get the opulences?
Yeah, so great opulences.
From the opulence supreme. That's how he got them.
Yeah, I mean, how come he got such a great position? I mean, the Lord gave such great mercy compared to other devotees.
The Lord gave it to him. That's how he got it. We heard yesterday, oh, he's such a nice boy. He wants his big kingdom. Well, you know what? I'll just give it to him. Because what he wanted, better than his father was Uttanapada, better than his father's father, who was Swayambhuva Manu, better than his father's father, who is Brahma. So what's better than Brahma? It's the spiritual world. He's just a little boy, but he really did his thing, you know, did everything that Narada said, and he really wanted his kingdom. So Vishnu said, you know what? I'm just going to give it to him. You know, it's mercy. He can give mercy however to whomever. So he was a fit candidate for receiving such opulence. We heard, because he didn't have a desire. By that stage, no desire for material opulence. So we can give him opulence and he can handle it. That's how it happened. He became squeaky clean and Vishnu saw, you know what? He's such a nice little boy. I'll give him the whole thing. You know, the presiding personality on his own abode in Swetadweep. With all the planets worshipping and, you know, not Dhruva, but the planet, that spiritual planet. He can be the presiding personality because he's fit. He wants to be my devotee and he has no other desire now. That's how it's possible.
Thank you, Maharaj. Okay. One more question, Maharaj.
Yeah.
About friend and enemy. Sometimes with by our action, sometimes we might become enemies or
yes,
unknowingly also.
The enemy within, that's what you're speaking, right?
Enemy within.
The mind becomes the enemy, not just somebody out there becomes enemy.
Yeah, and what if we become enemies of others by our actions unknowingly? Handle such situations.
Well, if you don't recognize that you have become somebody's enemy, you know, they may let you know. And you know, you with good intention, let's just give, you know, take it with that. That supposing you're not, you know, an ill-intentioned person, you're a good-intentioned person, but you do something with good intention, but it ends up hurting somebody and they feel badly towards you. I mean, it happens. It happens. So, when you come to know that, you can go and be apologized, appeal to the person. I understand that you feel hurt by something I did or said. When I did or said that something, this was my intention, but it didn't come out right. I didn't mean malice towards you. It came, didn't come out right. But if somebody actually has malice towards another person, that's different. But in your specific question, what do we do when we have offended another person or hurt another person? First, you know, it's good if somebody lets you know, because you may not even know you hurt another person. And when you do come to know, you apologize and mean it. And then the standard thing is the best apology is not just, gee, I'm sorry, but the best apology is you don't do it again. You don't repeat the same thing. That's the best one.
Thank you. Yeah.
Maharaj, extension for this question is
if
by explanation, if it goes wrong, like while we are apologizing, if it goes wrong,
it happens.
Still, yeah.
It happens.
Yeah. So how we need to come out of that?
Well, this standard procedure. This is now our acharyas teaching us. If you make an apology, and even the apology is misunderstood or it's not accepted, either way.
Yeah, by our explanation or something,
yeah, okay.
It goes.
Supposing
worse.
It's not understood, it's misunderstood.
Yeah.
Or supposing someone is so, you know, in a bad mood, they just don't accept your apology. Either way, what to do? That's your question.
Yeah.
Okay. So according to scripture, you give it some time and you make another pass at it, because it's what's in your heart, and you just say what's in your heart. You come to know they didn't accept or they misunderstood, and then you just keep that, I wish forgiveness. I can think of a situation where exactly, you know, I was in the situation that you're talking of. And I, as far as I know, there is another person who feels badly towards something I said or did that I didn't intend it to be the way that it was perceived. I spoke with them. They said, I accept your apology. Then later they said to somebody else that came back to me, rah, 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 rah. So they said they accepted, but they really didn't accept. And I don't want that standing. You know, when you leave this world, best not to have those things lingering. So, you know, then there's another situation where I apologized because it was just plain and simple a misunderstanding, and the person accepted. But I felt, he accepted, but did he really accept? But just by over, so this is another option for you or anyone. Just be very genuine in your warm regard and proper regard for that other person. Consistently, 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 consistently. And they become accepting that you genuinely are, you know, a person without malice or with ill intent or something like that. I just had an exchange like that with one devotee. It goes back 12 years, more than 12 years. Something that was said, and they felt something. Another person told me their feeling. Don't leave this lingering. So I went to the person. I said, oh, it's okay. But I felt there was still something. So over those 12 years, it's been consistent. I'm not like buttering the person up. I'm just being genuine about my regard for that person. And then recently, the last few days, some exchange with them about something else. I was just appreciating, you know, and wrote some appreciation about their service. And I could tell from the response, it was over, whatever that 12-year-old thing was, it's gone. But it was important to me to not leave that lingering. Now, sometimes you just don't even know. And sometimes there's somebody's impossible. They're just impossible. So you're just like, okay, that's the kind of person they are. Just going to be like that, and you just accept it. That's the way it's going to be because that's the way they are. But if there's a genuine rapport and there's some misunderstanding, either way, someone towards you or you towards someone or something, you stay with it patiently over time and just be a person of good character, of genuine care and concern consistently. And it has its effect. And then there's just, the persons that are irascible. You just keep a distance from them with no expectation, no judgment, just keep a safe distance. Something else.
Hare Krishna Maharaj. Regarding the taking the responsibility on that part, it may be easier for the immediate actions, taking the responsibility if the thing did not go well, but something would have happened earlier, because the reactions that I'm getting today is because of my past actions. Taking the responsibility of those actions is not easy. And in between, again, false ego comes into play, so that makes it more tougher. I mean, though we understand that we are responsible for our actions, so the example that your side you gave, it was very touching. I mean, we don't want to leave those lingering, but it's not easy. That I feel
that's
it's
right.
Very, very
that's
difficult.
Right. I mean, it gets really complicated sometimes.
And I mean, it's.
It's not easy. So now what?
Yeah, because, I mean, the example that you gave it, Maharaj, it was like very touching, because you can, I mean, the person can, I mean, I might leave it saying that, okay, the other person is like that, right? What can I do? What should I do? I mean, right?
There are cases that are like that. Some persons are just like, there's no point in investing. You just, from a distance, you pray and continue to be a well-wisher from a distance. You don't try to fix the thing that's broken. There are some situations like that. And Prabhupada would do like that with certain people, and Mr. Nair and all that. Okay?
So the previous part, I mean, how do I, from my stage, how do I let that false ego not come into play?
But just in principle. You have to cultivate acting from the spiritual platform. I'm spirit soul. My existence is meant for Krishna's pleasure. I'm sure this is not pleasing to Krishna. And so let me leverage that desire to be in my true identity and be Krishna's servant. And then the influence of false ego can be diminished or subside. Doesn't mean it's just going to get up and go away, but it'll be diminished gradually over time by cultivation of acting as Krishna's servant. And you'll start in certain areas and then just expand it. The areas that do work for you, then you just keep growing it and growing it and growing it. It becomes your life in all aspects of life, including the ones that trigger your false ego.
The reason I was, when I do that, right, sometimes I feel like it's like mental adjustment. It's
that's
not
okay.
Real.
It's just practice. Don't forget the horse and pay attention to the cart. Pay attention to the horse. The horse will pull the cart. Bhakti pulls this purification, not just adjusting the impure heart. Stay with bhakti. Krishna is to be pleased. And, you know, it starts with your japa and then your everything else, your reading and your worship and, you know, the areas where you get strength, you do that nicely. And then the areas where it's not so strong, you take from strength and apply it to those other areas. You cultivate bhakti. This is one of those topics, one of the five topics during the Vyasa Puja weekend of become a human. But, you know, it's, you don't just try to become a human. It's the starting point is bhakti. And we're not fit yet. But on the strength of bhakti, human traits, in one sense, they're quality of goodness, and in another sense, they're just human. Mm-hmm. Online.
This question is from Jiva, Sri Jiva. Is the ocean of milk in Dhruva Loka the same where the pastime of churning of the milk ocean between the demigods and demons took place?
My understanding is no. The understanding I have, there was some discussion about this some time ago, and in Bhumandala, there's different islands and oceans. It's that ocean of milk that was churned. Not the ocean of milk and sweet to do it.
This is one more question.
Okay.
From Chitkala Anand. What is the significance of physical exercise in Krishna consciousness?
Krishna says to do it in moderation. It helps keep the body and mind fit so you can do your service nicely. You say, you know, neglect and you end up not being able to do your service so nicely. So don't neglect. It doesn't have to be extreme. It can be, you know, mild, but moderate in the language of Bhagavad Gita, temperate or moderate. That's it.
This is a similar topic. I'm having conflict in my mind.
You are.
Because through the EC training, empathy communication, because my mind is thinking, why Krishna not give the basic needs taken care so that the...
Which basic needs are you speaking about?
Food, shelter, those things.
Animal necessities. Krishna doesn't take care.
In the sense like there is, devotee is like, struggle, work hard to get the money, like, especially in America, living in America, we need money.
I'm listening.
So then, those are the ones that is holding, for the moment, progression, for the progress of the devotees.
Oh, that you do that for Krishna. That's part of having a human form of life. It's not, don't be resentful to Krishna that you have prescribed duties. You accept them and do them for Krishna. When you become eligible, you don't require a material body anymore. And they don't have those same prescribed duties, but you have one, so you have to offer it to Krishna in a prescribed or dharmic manner. Okay. Yeah?
Maharaj, I had two questions.
Okay.
One is about the verse that is in Bhagavad Gita, the four types of people go to Krishna. So, when distress comes, sometimes it is easy to just go to Krishna.
Yeah.
And I observe in myself sometimes and in some other devotees also that practicing devotees, when there is some distress comes, not exactly like physical health or something, there is some kind of a core tendency being addressed repeatedly. And
what? There's a tendency to do what?
Core tendencies of anarthas are getting repeatedly addressed, which is nice. But sometimes when we hit the bottom, it feels like one may even go away from Krishna consciousness in a way, like just back to basics and nothing more than, I don't know if I'm able to put it right, but like one feels so weakened and weighed down by some of the distress situations that it doesn't really inspire to take more shelter, but just keep the basics going. And it feels like it's not really deeper shelter.
Anyway, what I gather is you're just describing unsteady bhakti in one of its ups and down phases. That's how I take it. I mean, there's another tendency, even for pious people, when there's some difficulty, which is speak if it gets really severe, one just goes completely into problem-solving mode. They completely forget, you know, depending upon Krishna. Just get like, you know, zoned in on, I got to take care of this problem. And, you know, back burner is, you know, Krishna bhakti. Front burner is, I got this problem. And then comes another one, then comes 10 of them. And so Krishna's completely gone. And so
it's kind of scary when some kind of the Krishna becomes a backbone.
Bhakti. And we're making choices at every moment. And we have our past tendencies, vasanas, that are, you know, prevailing because we're conditioned. So yeah, we have to work our way through all that conditioning. The opportunity is there, and there's unsteady bhakti in between us and there. So we just stay with it. The faithful, that's, you know, the good association factor, because they can help us when we get, you know, whatever, weak or sad or crumpled or something.
And the other question is about the offense part, like with Dhruva Maharaj, he wanted a kingdom and he really did not, I don't know if he really wanted his brother and his stepmother to be punished.
No.
So it was because they offended a Vaishnava, then
yes.
Krishna did basically.
Yes.
Yeah, okay.
Yes.
Okay.
Yes.
And
oh. Something online. One more online.
Okay, this is the same devotee, Chitkala Anand. She refers to Bhagavad Gita, text 27:28. Shutting out all external sense objects, keeping the eyes and vision concentrated between the two eyebrows, suspending the inward and outward breaths within the nostrils, and thus controlling the mind, senses, and intelligence. The transcendentalist aiming at liberation becomes free from desire, fear and anger. One who is always in this state is certainly liberated. So she's expressing she couldn't understand this part of this, the following point. The point is suspending the inward and outward breaths within the nostrils. She doesn't understand this part. And I think sorry, it's chapter 5, text 27-28, and it's this is the same devotee who asked about significance of physical exercise in Krishna consciousness. So the question is, what does it mean, suspending the inward and outward breaths within the nostrils?
This is part of an Ashtanga yoga system which we don't follow. The principle is there's seven pranas that move within the body, and it's not just the air that's out there and you breathe it into your lungs and then you exhale. It's not that. It's not just air, it's prana, life air. And there is a procedure that I'm not familiar with because it's not part of our practice or teaching, where one can suspend. It doesn't mean you die. It just means the movement of prana inward and outward is suspended. And there's some technical procedure of working towards that and then coming to that stage. And Dhruva had accomplished it. But, you know, sixth chapter speaks of it also. It's part of the Ashtanga process, which we don't follow. Okay?
One more question.
Last one.
Sri Radhika Mataji's question. So I think I asked about offense of the stepmother and the brother towards Dhruva,
yes,
and Krishna,
yes,
punished.
Yes.
So the question is, at that time Dhruva Maharaj was not a Vaishnava, so how was it Vaishnava Parad?
Well, you can say he was a Vaishnava, but I can say he was. He was a little boy. He wasn't, you know, a super personality. But we can assume reasonably that because his mother was such an exalted Vaishnav, he had heard from his mother about Vishnu Bhakti. And we can also assume reasonably that when Narada gives instructions about so many things, that he knew about those so many things, you know, the pastimes of the Supreme Lord and his different incarnations and things like that. He had Vishnu Bhakti. I said that? Do you remember that? You can show me the passage. I would appreciate reading it. And we, you know, it's reasonable to assume that he had some past in his previous life. But her particular point is, since when he was just 5 years old, he wasn't yet a Vaishnava. You know, like our devotee children, they're Vaishnavas. They don't have to be 5 years old to be considered Vaishnavas. Or chanting so many rounds a day and then they're Vaishnavas. They're Vaishnavas. Little Vaishnavas. Srila Prabhupada ki jai.